listen, you have to be courteous.
Okay.
Thanks for the introduction.
That's the kindest introduction we've had in a while.
That's right. Well, one of these critics I know because he was my former student and exceedingly difficult in that capacity. So I will introduce with great affection Mr. Chris Botafuxo, whom I don't know at all except for today. Chris and Chris.
Well, thanks, Omri, for inviting us. This has been great. So Chris and I want to present a project today that we call the Creativity Effect. And it comes, there are two motivations that intersect. So let me talk a bit about the motivations. And then Chris can talk about the protocol and our results. And then I can help you think a little bit about implications. And we're hoping to get as much input as possible on that. So motivations, there are a couple of things intersecting here. One is, you know, both of us had thought a bit about the endowment effects literature over a period of time. And one thing we noticed, both of us, is that if you look at all this literature, it goes back a long time. There are lots and lots of experiments involving a variety of goods, you know, the most trivial, like candy bars and coffee mugs, stuff that's much more important, like playoff tickets for sports games. So what you don't see is what we were interested in, which is endowment effects experiments that involve goods that are not merely endowed, but that people actually create. So we were just interested in finding out whether the findings in these endowment effects experiments would map on to situations in which the good being traded was not simply endowed, but was actually created by the person holding the good in its initial state. That was interesting to us. And then, you know, when we started to think about it, another motivation mixed in, which was thinking about IP law as it exists in the United States. IP law is mostly structured around strong property rules, not liability rules, although, of course, there are liability rules. Fair use is a liability rule. The compulsory license for musical compositions is a liability rule. But those are not the mainstream. Those are exceptions to the general trend of property rules. And there's a debate, you know, a kind of evergreen debate in IP law between property rules and liability rules. And you know, the disabilities of liability rules are pretty clear, right? You have to have a public actor of some sort set prices, right? Government agency of some sort, rather than prices being set as the result of some market transaction. You worry about mispricing when there's no market transaction to actually discipline anybody. So the problems with liability rules are pretty clear. I mean, the problem with the potential problem with property rules is less discussed. But in IP, right, the problem might be, we hypothesize, that if pricing anomalies, right, that are normally classed together somewhat uninformatively as endowment effects, drive the willingness to pay and willingness to accept figures of buyers and sellers apart, then you start in negotiations with the parties pretty far apart from one another. It requires more investment in negotiation to actually get to a deal. This is a class of transaction cost that we thought when we looked at the literature wasn't very well explored. We'd want to know something about this, right? Because in determining whether property rules or liability rules were better, and I say this cautiously because this paper doesn't make a conclusion about that. This paper just tries to provide some data for further analysis. But in determining whether you favor property or liability rules is the basic way to structure IP, you have to have, I think, a pretty good understanding of whether property rules are likely to lead to transactions at or near an optimal level, whether they're going to be efficacious in most instances. I think this is especially important in IP because both copyright and patent tend to locate initial entitlements in parties that are often very poorly situated to exploit commercially the creative work or the invention, right? Authors in copyright, inventors in IP, and patent. Patent has a very strong individual inventorship requirement. Copyright has a reasonably narrow work made for hire doctrine compared to what it might be, right? Where sponsors don't often get initial rights, but authors do. And so these, at least initial transactions, are often very important for exploitation. So that was our motivation, to add something to the debate in IP around property versus liability rules. So let's talk a bit about the experiment.
Great. So what we wanted to do was to create a kind of experimental model of IP markets.
And the way the standard endowment effect studies go is that you actually transfer the thing, right? The mug, the hunting permit, whatever it is. This, of course, is not the way intellectual property rights are generally transferred, licensed, sold, right? The thing that you end up selling, the primary value, the primary economic value anyway of the IP right, is a kind of, you know, your ability to seek rents from it, right? Your ability to license it to others, to make money off of the thing itself, right? Not the book, right? But the opportunity to license the book to others. So in order to do this, we created a contest with a fixed value payout at the end with a certain number of entries. So in the first one, we set up a contest for haiku, right? The little three-line poems with the five syllables and the seven syllables and the five syllables, right? And we had students come into the lab, or it actually was subjects from across Charlottesville, came into the lab and wrote a series of haiku for a contest. So we told them, we're going to choose, you know, one poem out of these 10 and give it a $50 prize, right? And so write the best haiku that you can to try to win the prize. We additionally brought in two other sets of subjects, one who were going to act as purchasers, as bidders or buyers of the rights, and another who were going to act as kind of mere owners of the rights. These were to be kind of stand-ins for some type of transaction intermediary, right? So what we ended up telling them, what we ended up telling the authors of the poems is, we're going to give you a chance now to sell your chance to win the prize, right? So indicate your willingness to accept, right, the least amount of money that you would be willing to accept to transfer your right to win the prize, right? You keep the poem, right? You're not transferring the poem, right? All you're transferring is this right to win the prize. How much would you be willing to accept? We tell the owners basically the same thing. For purposes of this experiment, right, this is your poem. How much would you be willing to accept to transfer it? And the buyers get kind of the opposite instruction, right? How much would you be willing to pay? And we tried, and we, you know, give them every indication that they're going to have to pay this amount, right? That these are live transactions. How much are you willing to pay to buy this poem's chance to win? And they get to see all of the other poems in the market, and they get to look at them and then make these types of decisions, and then answer a few questions at the end, right? So what we expected was this creativity effect. We expected a standard endowment effect that would create a valuation anomaly between the buyers and the mere owners, right? So that mere owners' willingness to accept figure would be higher than the buyers would be willing to pay. We thought that there would be an additional effect associated with creativity, right? That there's something special about creativity. So our hypothesis was that owner valuation would be higher, or sorry, author valuation would be higher than owner valuation, which would be higher than bidder valuation, right? So we ran the study, and we didn't confirm all of our hypothesis, right? So what we got in the first study was a substantial difference between authors and owners on the one hand and bidders on the other, right? So out of $50, authors and owners wanted, you see, approximately $17 or so to sell their chance to win the poem, whereas bidders were more or less rational, right? They said, you know, there's a 1 in 10 chance to win $50. You know, I can do some math, right? That's worth about $5, all things considered. I'm willing to pay somewhere around that, right? So we get a kind of standard endowment effect difference, right? What we don't get is our predicted creativity effect difference. Right. Well, in this case, they're not statistically significant. Error, in another study, the author number is slightly higher. These are all kind of very close together. We've done we did it a few different ways. They all turn out very similar. Yep.
These were random people, right?
Right. Most of them were undergrads from the University of Virginia. There were also other people from Charlottesville.
Right. So I'm just wondering whether the modesty that the authors are demonstrating here is a function of the fact that they're not professional.
Yeah.
They don't think of themselves as creative folk, but that if you did a different...
So this is study two, right? So give me a second, right? So this is what we get: no difference between these two. So we figure out why, right? One possibility is there is no difference, right? You know, it just doesn't exist in the real world, and you know, we have an accurate study that detected it. Another possibility is this is an artifact of our experiment, and the thing we hypothesized this time was that, you know,
here we brought students into the lab and said, write a haiku, right? And they wrote a haiku, and they wrote very nice haikus, but it only took them a couple of minutes or so, and they were externally motivated to do so. So we thought, what if we do this slightly differently, and we have students or subjects who are internally motivated and who have a substantial creative endowment, have spent some serious time doing this, right? These are just a couple of figures I can come back to. So we ran the same study again, this time with painting students at the Art Institute, right? So these were subjects who had engaged in kind of semester-long projects to produce paintings. And voila, right, we get the effect, right? So here we replicate our original endowment effect difference, right? Owners are still, you know, about, you know, somewhere between 2 and 3 times as high as buyers, right? But painters this time have shot all the way up. This time the prize is $100, not $50. And these are mean valuations with standard error bars, right? So now painters want a mean of about $75 to transfer a 1 in 10 chance to win $100, right? Buyers, again, are, you know, more, you know, in the range of rationality, right? Owners are substantially higher than that, right? So now we've got this creativity effect that we had hypothesized from the beginning that at least seems to appear in situations where there is substantial internal motivation and substantial creative endowment, right? So we didn't want to stop with just that. We thought, you know,
they're not giving away the picture, so
they're not, right.
This is strictly the effect for the thing they didn't create, which is a lot.
Well, it's a weighted lottery, right? It's a weighted lottery based on the quality of the painting or the poem or something like that, right? And that's what they're giving away, right? Not the thing itself, which is actually kind of surprising in some ways, right? We're showing an effect for non-complete transfer of the property.
Yeah, this is what we thought would be interesting in the first study. First thing we wanted to see was whether endowment effects results would flow into experiments where the transfer was involving non-rival property. Right, so you're not transferring the underlying good, but you're transferring some revenue stream that might be attached to the underlying good. And the first experiment at least confirmed one of our two hypotheses, and an important one, I think, that endowment effects, these valuation anomalies, whatever you want to call them, flow into transactions in non-rival properties. So this is the first experiment of that type. Now what we see here is we have paintings, which often are rival property, but we're treating them as non-rival property. And the endowment effects flow again into these results, but they also differ depending on role, differ very significantly depending on role. So that's where we've ended up. Next question is, well, why?
Right.
So it's a very quick clarification. The haiku is what you're trading back and forth are the rights to win the lottery, right?
Yeah. Right, same thing.
Why do you call those, right, non-rival?
The poems are non-rival.
Right.
You're not alienating the poem. So if I write a poem, I license it to a publisher, I haven't alienated the poem. I haven't, you know, I've lit his tape or I haven't extinguished mine.
You're trading a rival revenue.
Well, the revenue stream's a rival.
Yeah.
The underlying good to which it's attached, non-rival. That's what we're trying to model.
Okay, great. Dave?
So in this example, can the artist or the painter, do they get to still say that they want? There might be some reputational benefits.
Yeah, so we wanted to kind of bracket all of the reputational issues at this point. We have a new study in the works to kind of do that next. Right,
right, we want to know what the value of attribution is.
Right, so we wanted to kind of get all of that out there. So, you know, I mean, so at the end, you know, the contest was going to be, you know, announced, the winner of the prize was going to be announced. So it might be that there's some reputation in there as well, but there's no reason for it to affect the valuation itself. Right. Okay, so we wanted to know kind of what's going on here, right? Because we, you know, so there's been concern about some endowment effect studies that they just call things endowment effects without explaining the underlying psychological mechanisms, right? So we proposed 4 possible psychological mechanisms that could be going on, right? One could be a kind of emotional attachment to the poem or the painting. Another could be a kind of labor theory, right? You know, the more time you spend with it, the more you might care. A third is regret aversion. Right, that people didn't want to give these things up, or at least the contemplating someone else winning the prize with my painting was kind of hedonically negative, and people wanted to get additional compensation for that. Right, $10, the rational value of the poem or the painting or the poem wasn't going to be sufficient to compensate me for the hard feelings I'd have if other people won with, you know, what was mine. And finally, there was a kind of irrational optimism we wanted to check, right? Do people just really think that their stuff is awesome and much more likely to win, right? So what we end up finding is that, you know, when it comes to these, emotional attachment is no predictor of value at all, Right, so we have no evidence that, you know, the higher levels of emotional attachment among painters predict their valuation. The same is true for labor. Right, the amount of time the painter said they spent on it also doesn't predict their value. Regret aversion is.
So you're measuring these based on how they say I'm really emotionally attached to this.
Yeah, we ask them a question. You know, I mean, how emotionally attached do you feel to this? Yeah, I mean, it might not be an ideal measure of it, right? But at least it's a self-reported measure of you know quite a lot or not at all, right? And so not an ideal measure, but you know, at least a reasonable proxy for those types of things at a kind of first pass. We don't want to say that we're not getting any of that. We could be getting that, right? And obviously, we're not asking that question of the buyers and the owners, right? Because we just assume they're going to feel no emotional attachment, right? So there could be emotional attachment working through here, but if it is, it's kind of working, it might be working in a step function or something like that. Within the class of painters, it doesn't appear to have a direct effect.
Right.
So regret aversion, the analysis is a little a little mixed. On the one hand, painters don't seem to be experiencing more regret. Right, so when we ask them to kind of imagine a counterfactual in which, you know, they have sold the painting and it wins in someone else's hands, they have higher levels of regret, five compared to, you know, kind of 3.5 to 4 for the others. This isn't a significant difference. It is a difference, but not a significant one. Pardon? Right. Again, you know, those are well within the, you know, the difference. So and again, you know, the quality is higher as well. Although when controlling for role, there is a very, very nearly statistically significant effect of regret. So across roles, the more regret you anticipated feeling, the higher the valuation you were likely to give. Right. So this leads us to the big conclusion. What's really going on here is this probability of winning, right? And so you see here, this is the predicted probability of winning. We just asked them, what's the likelihood that your painting is going to win this prize, right? And you see painters here gave themselves a 50-50 shot at winning, right? They think, you know, I'm almost, you know, there's a pretty good chance I'm going to win this, whereas owners and buyers were substantially lower.
But buyers are also nuts, aren't they?
So there are a couple of explanations for what might, do you want to feel that one?
I mean, there are a couple of explanations for this. One is that you present the buyer one painting and they attach some meaning. I've been presented this painting and there's a reason for it, right? So that's an artifact of experimental design. Still, painters are quite significantly higher than buyers or owners. Another possible mechanism is that they just simply get attached to it, right? It might be that even for the short period of time that buyers have, you know, contact with this painting, they get some attachment. This attachment affects their projection of the chance of winning. What's important for us isn't so much the absolute projections of winning as the relative ones.
Right. If I need to just kind of not grade at math, but still get the basic.
That's also possible.
Here. Right,
then, you know, I want to trade against
these guys in some futures market. Right. So this is what we've got. So what we've got is a study where it seems like, you know, the thing that is driving our result is kind of, you know, substantially irrational, right? There could have been other things that were driving our result that were, you know, potentially meaningful and that we might want to care about and, in, you know, and make sure we're taken care of as a matter of intellectual property law.
Yeah.
But here we see, you know, highly irrational painters. And so the question is kind of, what should IP do about this?
Yeah, I just want to pound that home, because in a lot of the endowment effects studies, this kind of a reflex. You find a delta between willingness to accept and willingness to pay, and you move immediately to the question of, well, should we debias and how should we debias? And to us, I mean, whether you should consider debiasing at all has to do with why you think this delta between willingness to pay and willingness to accept is opening up. So if you think, for example, that it's regret aversion, okay, then I don't frankly see a reason to be too concerned about debiasing, because if I'm a painter and I anticipate regret, if I alienate the painting and then the painting turns out to be a masterpiece, that's part of my preference function, and who's to say that that's a toxic part of my preference function? I mean, we can mount arguments for this, but it doesn't seem to me obvious that regret aversion is something that I want to debias. On the other hand, probability of winning, right, on the other end of the spectrum, what we find is that probability of winning is statistically quite tightly connected with valuation, right? So it's driving valuation. But although people are acting rational in linking probability of winning to valuation, they're acting very irrationally in deducing the probability of winning. So, you know, there's a better case for debiasing, I think, given that most of these results seem to be driven by just wide scale, misunderstanding of what's likely to happen. Keep in mind, all these experiments are zero-sum games, so that even though there are quality differences among these paintings, the median valuation should be 10. Mark?
So whether or not you want to de-bias, it seems to me that the results have pretty substantial implications for the likelihood of efficient licensing.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And maybe you're about to talk about that.
We are.
Okay.
So the first headline here, there are two headlines. First, I think the first experiment maps the endowment effect literature onto creative goods that are non-rival, which I'm happy about. The second experiment raises, I think, the possibility of something that we think is idiosyncratic to creative works. That is what we call this creativity effect. It's a valuation anomaly tied not simply to ownership, but to the making of something, right? Which, I mean, to me, runs with intuition, right? But the fact that it runs with intuition doesn't settle it for me, but it's comforting. So what does this mean for licensing? Well, again, I want to be modest about this. So there's this long-standing debate between liability rules and property rules, and we don't presume to settle this or even come close to it. We're just offering some data. On the side of liability rules, right, we have this obvious weakness of liability rules, which I alluded to earlier. You know, some of that weakness is being addressed by work like Dan Crane's, okay, who says, well, if you actually look how liability rules work, there's bargaining in the shadow of them, and God knows that's often the case, right? Just take, for example, music composition licensing. Very few music compositions are licensed at the statutory rate. They're licensed at rates negotiated through an intermediary, right? So there's all kinds of bargaining going on in the shadow of that rule. It's surprising to me we didn't notice that before. Kudos to Dan for noticing it. So there's another piece of data about liability rules that may shift the way we look at them. And I hope that we've provided another piece of data about property rules that shift the way we look at them, right? So often, I think, heretofore, we've structured an IP law based heavily on property rules on the kind of presumption that these rules are efficacious in getting these transfers underway. That presumption, I think, is pressured a little bit by our findings because if the willingness to accept, willingness to pay delta is anything like what we think it is coming out of these experiments, you have to worry about the amount of negotiation investment that's required to bridge it. So again, the debate, this doesn't settle anything, but I think I hope we've offered something that enriches the debate. Scott.
So, just to build on that to see whether I'm correctly understanding what you're saying, you're envisioning that there could be several subpopulations of people in the creative space that some could want to suppress other use of their stuff, some could want to encourage other use of their stuff. Of the ones who want to encourage other use of their stuff, they could be confident in their own ability to achieve that effect, or they could be skeptical of their own ability to achieve that effect. And so you could imagine, for example, those who want it done but don't think they can do it, they might actually have your effect but still be transaction facilitators. And so it would be, for that population, detrimental to have a policy conclusion be that this effect means liability rule treatment is a plus. For that population, liability rule treatment would be a huge minus.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, so let me just try to make where I think this is headed clear, but this is just what I think this is headed. I'm not there yet. I think what this suggests is that we've got to know a lot more about how different populations would approach this. So before I would recommend any policy changes, I'd want to know a lot more. So here's one policy change, work made for hire, right? So if you look at this data, it suggests, well, we should soften the inventorship requirement in patent, and we should expand the work made for hire doctrine in copyright. Now, for various reasons, that pushes against all my other priors on both of those things.
Although, by the way, just following that, on the inventorship setting, you could, as you say, soften the inventorship. Or you could just have a kind of a more generous read of implied in fact contracts that shift the ownership to the owner.
Right, you could do it in IP, you could do it internal to IP, or you can do it in contract doctrine, right? Either way, if you have rules that lead to more sponsors having initial rights or ownership, then you would work in a way that diminishes these effects.
And then stated differently, that would all be consistent with the literature that the practitioner community has long written about, which is that there's kind of a big advantage to maintaining the value of these assets, to getting ownership of these assets as early as possible into the hands of a single commercially friendly entity like a single human being, a single corporation, a single trust, because unless and until you do that, you have massive coordination problems, strategic holdouts, and all those other. And so what you're saying is, yeah, if you eliminate, strip away the esoteric preferences and concentrate in a single decision maker, then the value of the asset socially is maximized.
Yeah, I mean, that's broader than anything that we've shown.
And you know, still have the owner
third, bond. Yeah, third parties are no panacea, right? Third parties are still pretty awful, right?
I wasn't going to get into that.
Yeah. Right.
That's what the data show.
Yeah.
My question, I can understand how the gap is damaging the licensing market, and that's very clear. The question is on the dynamic equilibrium type questions. Is it like this creative effect? Because that means we can give a smaller incentive to creation, still people will overestimate the work.
That's another implication. So another implication is, and this is, again, this is odd to me, but it flows from this, that people are living in an illusion. And so when you talk about the next copyright extension, right, we're going to extend to life plus 90, well, one thing you should factor into the economic analysis that will never occur in Congress, but would if, you know, if it were a better Congress, is that, well, people are already under the illusion that they have a, 50-some-odd percent, 52.5% chance of winning our contest.
It's a little tough to know exactly, though, right? I mean, it is an endowment effect, right? You actually have to be endowed with it or create it.
That's a different question.
Yeah. Right, so, but we wouldn't necessarily.
It raises a question, is there a pre-endowment effect?
That's an important question for us to figure out. It's not, I mean, I think it's related and suggested by these data, but I'm not sure that it is.
Richard?
You know.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that troubles me about this is that you're trying to infer the way in which people actually deal with paintings when they deal with prizes for paintings. And so, for example, I've been to a lot of galleries with a lot of artists and so forth, and if you start thinking of them as selling a portfolio or a collection and asking about whether you're going to see this, you're going to come up with very different answers. So, for example, suppose what you do is you say to somebody, here are 10 of your pictures. Which do you think is most likely to win the prize?
Right.
They're not going to come up with 500% chance of winning, right? If those are the only
things. Are you sure of that?
If they're the only ones in the contest, right? I mean, they're picking which of their paintings do they think the judges will pick in order to put in an art exhibit somewhere else. When you look at these things and you watch the way they price them for sales and so forth, I mean, checking out the relative values doesn't seem to show anything like the kinds of anomalies that you're catching here. And so what I'm wondering about is whether or not this is the same kind of distortions you get with these really wild valuations by virtue of the simulation. So, you know, one of the standard behavioral economics stuff that drives me nuts is that you have a guy, you can give him a cookie today, or you could give them a cookie an hour from now, they decide to take two cookies, one cookie now as opposed to two cookies later, and you infer that the effective rate of interest is 9,000,000%. And then you look at the commercial loans, and they're at 4.25%, right? I mean, well, obviously, there's something going on here about the experiment, and so I'm just, you know,
right,
I think
there's a lot there.
I mean, it's not that I disagree with the creativity effect and so forth, but I mean, you know, if this was the situation, you wouldn't see these guys running galleries. What the artists do in my world is, you know, I make an edition of 50 photographs, and I'm always going to keep two and sell 48. Right? I mean, you know, it seems to me that the market reflects that. By virtue of having a portfolio of goods, the behaviors that you see, all of a sudden, I mean, they're consistent with this model, but they don't have any of this kind of bizarro quality about them, which means that you don't have to draw inferences from this about how you license and the Copyright Term and Extension Act. Every artist holds back. You just look at it. They have 8 artist proofs, right? I keep 10, I sell 150. And that's reflecting the creative value, giving it to friends and so forth. So I think, in effect, that the anomalies that you talk about are true, but the implications for social policy are largely dissipated when you actually put it back into real-world settings. I mean, that's my insight.
Let me try to pick a couple of things out of there. So first of all, again, with the paintings, we are not simulating a gallery. We're simulating a publishing contract. Okay, so that's importantly different. If we were to run experiments on how people trade the painting, I think what we'd find is we'd find the endowment effect. And we'd find that the endowment effect is stronger for painters there as well. But we haven't done that yet. With respect to the...
One painter that I know, they're desperate to sell this stuff.
They want their stuff to hang in people's homes.
Yeah. Look, this is a good point, right? It might be that there are other things going on, that people have other values other than kind of, you know, this, you know, rent-seeking maximization. Right, and I think we're in a position to test those as well. Right, you know, it might be that the starving artist really just, you know, I want people to see my work, and that diminishes the effect some. But it's tough to know, right?
But wanting to hang in a good gallery is important. I mean, I know a lot of these artist guys, and I've never seen any of them say, "Oh my God, I'm going to have to sell my painting." What they do is they have a deep pang of regret, and they cash in a check at a 10% discount.
Okay, but the deep pang of regret is exactly the "Oh my God, I have to sell my painting." Right? I'm not going to own it anymore. It's leaving.
Yeah, I understand that you have it, but the point is, you always manage to overcome it. I've never seen a case in which it says, "I'm taking this off." Once or twice, when they give it out to a
but
dealer, he says,
"Would you?"
What you see them saying is, I've done this to me, says, the owner really likes this painting. And what does that mean? They're not going to give you a discount, but they'll always sell it at the list price. I mean, literally, that is the way it translates out.
Yeah, I just want to work through a little bit what you think this implies for efficient licensing. So the endowment effect, if I'm catching the mechanism correctly, is a function of a sense of desert, or essentially. Investment in your model, it's I've invested a lot of time and effort. So does that count or not in your sort of hedonic utilitarianism when you're trying to figure out which direction the price should go? Is it that liability rules will undercompensate because they won't take that into account? It's that, you know, I don't think you can derive a valence from your observations. And I'm wondering if you think you can and which way it cuts.
So first of all, it's not labor or emotional attachment, right?
Right.
That's part of the point. It's irrational optimism. So, okay, so there's a couple of things that you can get out of that. First of all, I don't feel the same strength that, I don't feel that the argument for protecting irrational optimism is particularly strong, right? So, okay, so if we're going to talk about how that would play into liability rules, well, if liability rules underprice from the perspective of someone who's irrationally optimistic about their chances of success, well, that's too bad. That sounds good to me.
How are you regressing emotional attachment to probability of winning? You ask, do you feel attached to this?
Yeah,
that seems to me different from, do I think I'm going to win because I put this work in and I deserve it? Those strike me as different things.
Right, right. So see, the question, it's a Likert scale, right? It's a 1 to 10 Likert scale, which says, you know, all things considered, how much do you, how emotionally attached do you feel to this work, right? You know, and 1 is not at all, and 10 is something like, you know, very, very much, or, you know, very intensely, or something like that, right? We don't, norm the scale or anything, like, but this is, we think we can get at some aspect of emotional attachment in that way. And look, that would be a different situation if it were something like emotional attachment or something like regret that seemed to be driving our results, right? We would have very good reason, as Chris said earlier, for thinking that this is part of folks' utility function and that people might be making, appropriate decisions about, their unwillingness and their reluctance to transfer the property, right? But if they are, if their only reason or their primary reason for their reluctance to trade the property is because they have, irrationally over-optimistic ideas about their likelihood of winning, right? Then they would be better off transferring the property at a much lower rate, right? You know, they would be better off making these sales and getting the $15, right? Than holding on to stuff that is not going to win because they insist on pricing it at $75.
So your idea is that I've taken care of the notion that I think I'm more likely to win because I feel I should deserve to win because I've done this work. Do you think that's picked up when you say you feel emotional attached?
If there was a relationship between when you regressed emotional attachment against probability of winning, if those two things were significantly associated, then I would worry that the two things were actually tied up one and another. But that's not what we see.
These are imperfect proxies for a variety of the things that might be going on, and we'd be really grateful for kind of better ways to test them. Yeah. So if you've got suggestions for how we can get at these issues, we'd really love to hear them. Yeah.
My assumption is that the endowment effect is a psychological phenomenon that the person is consciously aware of. Is that correct?
Generally so, right.
Because it makes me worry about asking questions such as, are you emotionally attached to to this object because they may not think they are, but subconsciously they are very attached. And, you know, it seems to me that is sort of the definition of the endowment effect. So I worry a little bit about just asking those kind of questions. But I do understand, of course, that these kinds of experiments have to do those kind of things. On a more a positive note, I would say that one of the real contributions, at least for me, of the paper was getting me to think about that there are really a lot of subcomponents to the endowment effect. For example, one that I think about is I get loyal to my old cars for some reason, and I probably would sell a newer car for fair market value. It's totally irrational, of course, but it seems to me that that might be like a first cousin to the creativity effect that you're talking about.
Do you think our emotional attachment question would pick up that response? Right, when we asked you how emotionally attached do you feel to your car, you know, you'd probably say 9.5, right, or something like that. And thus, if you overpriced, right, then I mean, this is what we were hoping to get, right? Exactly that.
Yeah.
That people would say, yeah, this is, you know, this painting, you know, I've spent, you know, months of my life, you know, dredging up my soul to, you know, make it appear on the canvas, and thus I care deeply about it, and thus I am, you know, really reluctant to give it up, right? So that's, you know, that's kind of, I mean, look, we could try galvanic skin responses as well, right, or something else like that. It's just a question of kind of what are the best proxies for these things.
It's hard to get the IRB to let you do galvanic skin
right.
responses.
Jonathan?
So I just want to offer a couple of maybe optimistic stories about this, positive stories, and hear your reactions. So first of all, I mean, if you're right that this is really being driven primarily by the probability of winning, and by the way, you might want to check whether those differences are statistically significant, then it seems like a running royalty is really going to go a long way to solving the problem when a running royalty is possible. Now, obviously, in the paper, you point out a whole lot of situations where it might be difficult to negotiate a running royalty. But in those situations, you know, the typical kind of author-publisher context where running royalties are standard, not to mention not to be easy, that looks like it might be a really terrific solution to the fact that you're picking up on. And the second thing is, Chris, I think I heard you say early that you think that the inflated value for buyers, and possibly also owners, is driven to some extent by the fact that you're telling someone, that's your painting, you know, buy this one or none other. And that sounds absolutely right to me. And people have done the same studies.
It's a framing effect.
Yeah, exactly. It's all framing effects. It's right within the heartland of the endowment effect literature and so forth. But of course, that's not typically how the sort of agent interactions work in real life, right? You know, the literary agent for an author and a publisher
right.
can say.
Keep in mind, though, what direction does that point? So if the framing effect was absent, this would be what it is, this would be what it is, and this would be 5. Right. Ten. In this experiment.
For owners, it's different, right? So it might be, so the literary agent has you give it to your intermediary literary agent. The literary agent has, you know, a million different of these mm-hmm. things, right? And so the literary agent may not be nearly so attached to any of them.
Oh,
might
we agree
really
with that.
To push the, push,
so
push
these owners are imperfect. What they're meant to represent is intermediaries, like the literary agent,
yeah.
right? But that's hard to model because literary agents are in the business and they have experience.
Right.
These owners are people who walk in and we lie to them, we're given approval to lie, and we say, this is yours, okay? So, okay, it's an approximation of an intermediary out in the real world, but it's not an intermediary out in the real
I think,
world.
And actually,
but that's exactly the point.
But
so this suggests that intermediaries will be a lousy solution. In the real world, they may be a somewhat better
no,
solution.
No. I don't think we say they're lousy. I think
right.
we say, you know, we think intermediaries have a role. We're not as confident as we might be.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. For what it's worth, though,
friendly optimistic story.
Fair enough.
For what it's worth, I think, you know, these owners actually, you know, if anything, there might be a negative confound for us. It make it harder to predict because
yeah.
these are not actually owners, right? They are, you know, the people who've been given gifts in effect, right? You now have a right that you didn't have before. Whereas in the standard intermediary situation, people
they
might have skin in the game and thus have even greater effects because, you know, they've chosen to maybe,
yeah,
right? But it could cut in the it could cut in the other direction
yeah,
as
yeah,
well.
Yeah.
Yep.
So there's something about the basic
structure of the experiment that I'm trying to I'm not sure, don't feel comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't test for I guess, experimental design reasons, a sale of, you know, a creation to a potential buyer, because
right.
we don't know valuation. You sold a gamble, you know. So imagine it had nothing to do with, let's, you know, simplify it. It's not about art. I have a lottery ticket and then will I sell it to you? Mm-hmm. We'd say, well, there might be a market for it if you are, you know, depending on our risk preferences. So we would expect that if I am the seller, I'm a more risk-loving, there will be no transaction. If I'm more risk-averse, there will be a transaction. And maybe what you're capturing is basically the fact if we find that there are, you know, the story, the pessimistic story that you are articulating is that there will be no transactions, and we kind of worry about property rules generally and licensing. But maybe what you're finding is that people who have created their own art are more risk-loving with respect to that. They really want the risk because the upside is disproportionately valuable for them, whereas the buyers, you know, they're just, you know, that's a portfolio of investments.
Yeah, for what it's worth, we actually ran a study that tried to deconfound some of these differences. So the first study we ran a lottery condition where...
Do we have that slide?
I don't have the slide, unfortunately. Right, so we ran it where there was no contest. It was merely one of these poems will be drawn out of a hat to win. And we got a delta between the lottery valuations, which showed an endowment effect pattern, right, and the higher the higher effect with the contest, right? So, you know. So this is.
What's the endowment?
So this is the difference. Unwillingness to sell the lottery ticket. People often won't sell their lottery tickets
version.
For two or three times the amount that they were sold.
Capturing
there exactly
irrationality.
Yeah, we're capturing the anticipated people's disutility curve is steeper than their utility curve, right? So they anticipate greater disutility from transferring the winning lottery ticket than they anticipate from winning. Well,
obviously,
this study doesn't have that because they don't choose their number, so to speak.
By the way, one other question about this. You call them buyers. If you're actually working in the art world, they're collectors in many cases, at which point a lot of the subjectivity comes back in on both sides of the market.
Yeah, again, we can't capture every nuance of the art market in these highly stylized experiments.
This is a very important point.
I understand. So that the idea is now to press on ecological validity step by step.
Yeah. I'm sorry, can I offer one of the response to Omri's questions sort of on behalf of
this? Just ask this question, but take it.
I'll be very, very quick. I mean, so when people do endowment effect studies, one of the things that they think is going on is people's preferences adapt to the thing in front of them. So you give me a mug and I start thinking to myself, a lot of these ways I can use this mug, that's really great. Give me a pencil, same effect, right? So the haikus and the paintings, right, one thing that might be going on is I've got this painting in front of me, I'm looking at this painting, it's growing on me, I'm learning about it, I'm starting to like it, other people may start to like it also. And that can generate, it's an irrational, but it's a way of generating an endowment effect with a lottery ticket that's consistent with all the other endowment effect studies.
Yeah, and there's been a bunch of them with lottery tickets, and the magnitude of the endowment effect in the lottery ticket studies tends to be lower than in other studies, but it's still there.
Yeah. No, the lottery ticket that depends on preferences to some extent, you might reverse that trend.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So yeah, those studies are already there, and the difference of our study from a lottery study is, first of all, part of our study is a contest, right? So judgments of quality enter into it, judgments of quality that are zero-sum, but nonetheless leak into people's valuation. And then in our study with the painters, right there, you have a valuation anomaly that you can't explain as a lottery simply because there's a delta between owners and creators. So there's some specific, whether it's regret aversion or risk-seeking, there is a difference.
Our two distinguished authors are
following.